This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. An invasive snail infected with a parasite has been responsible for killing thousands of migrant birds in Lake Onalaska and parts of the Upper Mississippi River near La Crosse. Many waterfowl eat the snails and in turn become infected by the parasite. With fall migration season upon us, we thought it would be a good idea to get an update on the problem and the progress made towards finding a solution. Greg Sandland is an associate professor of biology and is part of the River Studies Center at UW-La Crosse, which has taken the lead in the research. I asked him to talk about the invasive snail and how it showed up in the Mississippi River.
Actually, it arrived in North America in the late 1800s, around 1880, and it was introduced into the Great Lakes region at that time. Spread throughout the Great Lakes, actually ended up in a number of water bodies out towards the east, but it was pretty much contained in those areas up until 2002. When there was a relatively large die-off that occurred on the Mississippi River, members from USGS actually went out to investigate that and found the snail species that contained these parasites in it that had been linked to waterfowl mortality previously in areas along the St. Lawrence River. So it was at that point that they ended up being found in the Mississippi River.
So can you talk about the effects that the snail, which is then infected with three types of parasites.
Actually, we found a fourth one now.
Oh, you found a fourth?
Yes,
Things just keep getting better with
this.
They do.
More and more complexity.
So can you talk about what effect that has had on, I know there's been some issues in Lake Onalaska, but also in the Upper Mississippi River area?
Across the Upper Mississippi River, the parasites being transmitted via these snails are causing waterfowl die-off. So that's not just restricted to Pool 7, actually. That also pertains to some of the lower pools as well. In fact, last year and the year before that, there was greater levels of waterfowl die-off in Pool 8 than we've seen recently in Pool 7. So it looks as though there might even be a shift going on where mortality is decreasing in Lake Onalaska, but we actually see these increasing levels of mortality occurring in some of the lower pools. And we've also got we know that there have been introductions of the snail and the parasite in Lake Winnebogoshish in Minnesota, and we've also got reports of the snail and the parasite occurring in a number of lakes out west as well in Montana and the like, so it seems to be spreading.
And when you talk about waterfowl die-off, I mean, it's a pretty large number. I've seen, I don't know if you can talk about that.
Yeah, hundreds to thousands of birds are dying during every migration event. So last year, there were hundreds of birds that were reported dead in Pool 7. Thousands of birds reported dead in Pool 8. And that was, again, just in the fall migrational period.
And that's not including spring, then?
That's not including spring. So those numbers, they aren't as high as you find in the spring migration, but still there are substantial numbers of waterfowl that perish during the spring migration as well.
Why in the fall time are there more birds dying?
I think that's a great question. And I think a lot of it actually has to do with the densities of snails at particular points in the year. So coming off the summer, the snails are still in relatively good habitat. And so the densities remain relatively high as the birds are migrating through in the fall. Then they go into a period where there's ice on, colder temperatures. You likely get a loss of snails during that period of time. We've got some data that are actually leading us to believe that, so that sort of support that idea. In the spring, the ice comes off, and likely due to potential overwintering mortality, you've got lower densities of snails, so the birds likely don't have as many snails to feed on in the spring relative to the numbers that they have in the fall.
And can you talk about some of the waterfowl that this is affecting?
Well, it primarily influences coot, American coot, and also lesser scaup, although up to 15 different species of waterfowl are affected. But when you actually look at the numbers and break the numbers down, the hundreds and thousands of individuals dying tend to come from those two species.
Do the parasites then affect these two birds more than they would like a mallard duck?
That is a great question.
Okay.
So experimental evidence actually suggests that a number of waterfowl species are equally susceptible, including mallards, like you say. The only species that seems to be a little bit refractory to infection are wood ducks. So given the fact that we've got high levels of lesser scaup and coot perishing relative to these other species, it may be differences in their feeding ecology, for example, or when specifically they're migrating through relative to when the densities of the snails are at their highest. So it doesn't seem as though it's sort of some sort of inherent immunological resistance to it. It seems as though it may be something more ecological.
Can you talk about what happens? I'm sure it's not a very lovely process, but what happens when the birds are
actually ingest them? Actually, it isn't. It's very nasty. So the birds end up feeding on snails. Usually within a short period of time, the parasites begin establishing in the intestinal tract of the birds. Shortly thereafter, they attach to the intestinal wall and in some cases actually burrow down into the lining of the intestine, which in turn generates lesions along the intestinal tract. And currently it's believed that those lesions are a combination of the direct effects of the parasite and also due to the immunological responses of the birds themselves, sort of overreacting to these parasite burdens. So lesions along the intestinal tract lead to hemorrhaging, and these birds will end up bleeding out and dying within 4 to 7 days after they've been exposed to a lethal dose. And the really unfortunate and sobering aspect of this is that a single snail out on the Mississippi River can contain 100, 200, 300 of these parasites. And that's over a lethal dose for at least some of these species.
Do these parasites affect the snails physically, or do they just play host?
They do. So when the parasite first gets into the snail, they actually end up sterilizing the snail. So the parasites end up moving into the gonad of the snail, and in the case of one particular species, the parasites literally feed on the gonad and the snail is no longer able to reproduce. That actually ends up taking some time, at least in one of these species that we've been looking at. It can take 8 to 10 weeks for that to occur. But after that period, you can actually look into a snail and all you see is parasite in the area where the snail's gonad should be.
How big are these snails?
The snails themselves, they get up to 11 to 13 millimeters, so they're not a particularly large snail.
Do the birds have to ingest the snail, or, I mean, is there also, are the parasites just in the water freely?
The parasite can only transmit to the birds when it's in a form within the snail.
Okay.
It has to be in a very specific encysted form before it can be transmitted to the waterfowl.
Are these snails, are they affecting other snails within the water, and are they affecting anything else within the ecosystem?
Again, another great question. So, and that's actually an area of research that we are actively pursuing at the moment. Based on work that's been done out east, it's been shown that increasing numbers of this particular snail species correlate with decreasing numbers in native snail species. And we've got hints that that might be happening out on the Mississippi River, but we don't have anything sort of experimentally sound to confirm that yet. So we've actually got students working on that right now to see whether or not we've got competition occurring between native snails and Bithynia. Right now, if you actually go out and sample Pool 7 and Pool 8 of the upper Mississippi River, Bithynia makes up about 25% to 30% of the snails that we find out there. So it's now a very large player in the snail assemblage that we find in this area.
So let's talk about some of the research that UW-La Crosse is doing in the River Studies Center, and maybe there's some other players involved. You were mentioning that you did some studies over this summer. Maybe do you want to talk about the most recent discoveries that you've come across?
Sure. Well, actually, over the summer, we've been involved in a number of research avenues. One is actually looking at competition. So we've been doing both field and laboratory experiments, looking to see how well this invasive species fares with a number of different native species. In addition to that, we're also just trying to get a feel for what happens with the interaction between the invasive snail and the parasite. Until now, nobody's really done anything experimental. Nobody's looked to see how these parasites fare in the native species of snail. So that's something else that we are actively looking at over the summer also. And we found that at least with one of the parasites that ends up killing the waterfowl, it not only goes through the invasive snail, it also goes through almost every other snail species that we use in our experiments. So it seems as though it could be transmitting to waterfowl not only through ingestion by the invasive snail, but also when the native snails are being ingested.
So when students are participating in this research, can you talk about some of the things that they're doing?
Yeah, so actually they're involved in basically every aspect of the research. So again, the work that was done over the summer, students were expected to get up to speed on the background of the system, read papers that have been done previously on this particular system, and then we actually have them develop hypotheses based on some of the open-ended questions that are still available. They end up coming up with the designs for their experiments, and they end up conducting those experiments themselves. So they literally run the projects from the inception of the project all the way through to the final write-up, which can be in poster form, or hopefully eventually it'll be in manuscript form as well that we can then submit to journals around the country and the world.
And I saw in one of the papers that you sent over ahead of time, you talked about a grant that UWL received last year, and it seemed to be incorporating mathematics and biology.
It absolutely does. This is something we are very, very excited about. It's an NSF-funded project that we call the UBM CORE, CORE standing for Collaborations on Riverine Ecology. And it does. It involves individuals in biology, myself and Dr. Roger Harrow, and individuals in mathematics, Dr. James Pierce and Dr. Barb Benny. And the idea here is to actually get students involved in projects that occur at the interface between mathematics and biology. So right now we've actually got 4 students, 2 from mathematics, 2 from biology. They're in pairs with 1 student from biology, 1 student from mathematics paired up together. And we actually ask them again to address questions underneath this general umbrella of disease dynamics on the Mississippi River. And we actually have them try to address those questions using, again, mathematical approaches, so developing mathematical models. And then trying to support those models with empirical assessments. So those can be, again, laboratory experiments, field collections, those sorts of things. And so right now we're just finishing off the first cohort, and that has been an incredibly gratifying experience, both for us as faculty and also, I think, for the students. They've learned a lot. So the mathematicians are certainly becoming biologists, and the same thing with biologists. They're starting to understand the mathematics a lot more, which is exactly what we had hoped for with this particular program.
This just seems like such a huge task to take on, and obviously there's a lot that you have to study and look into. What's the final plan? Like, what would you ultimately like to accomplish with the studies?
Ideally, what we would like to do is to find out what point in the life cycle plays the most important role in transmission of the parasite and persistence of the parasite. And actually, we use mathematics to try to get at that kind of a question. And then if we're actually able to establish that, then we can think about some potential control measures that we could implement to try to, for example, maybe kick back snail densities in areas where we end up finding the largest numbers of birds. Or perhaps we may be able to modify the environment in certain areas of Pool 7 or Pool 8 to prevent the snails from establishing in areas where you might find large numbers of birds congregating. But we really need to find out where in the life cycle, where the most important point is in the life cycle that allows for, again, the parasite to persist before we can progress with these larger scale manipulations.
Has anything been tried yet to either get rid of these invasive snails or to cut back on the population?
Yeah, there have been a few manipulations that have taken place. The largest one took place a few years ago in an area around Arrowhead Island in Lake On, Alaska. Individuals actually ended up laying down sandy substrates on one side of the island to try to push back the bithyniids. It seems as though you tend to find lower numbers of snails in areas where you've got smaller substrates. And at first, it seemed to be working. The snails ended up being at lower densities after these smaller substrates were put in place. But because of the activity of the river, a lot of that substrate ended up washing away, revealing, again, substrates that were a little bit larger, and the snails have actually taken to those substrates relatively well now. Very good idea, again, and it seems to fall in place that these smaller substrates, that the snails don't do as well on these smaller substrates, but actually keeping those smaller substrates in place is a difficult thing to do given how much energy there is in the river system and how dramatically that energy changes throughout the season.
And you're listening to Newsmakers. My guest today is Greg Sandlin. He is an associate professor at UW-La Crosse's Department of Biology and the River Studies Center. I'm wondering if you can talk about the role humans may or may not play in this. I mean, we've all heard about the zebra mussels.
Right.
And, you know, make sure you clean your boat. But
Right. Well, I mean, this all certainly started via anthropogenic means in the 1880s. The snails are believed to have come over in ballast water, either in ballast water of boats or in reeds that were being transported over to North America at the time. And likely that was a similar situation here as well. The snail likely traveled into the Mississippi via human means. What that specific mechanism is, we don't know at this particular point in time. One of the issues with this snail is that when it immediately hatches from the eggs, it is very, very small and very, very hard to see. And likely a lot of the movement of the snail that's occurred along the Mississippi River may have been due to these smaller snails attaching to vegetation and moving down the river, or even birds. They may be attaching to birds and migrating via birds that way. Likely these snails could end up on boats, parts of boats and the likes. So I guess the rule of thumb would be try to clean your boat as well as possible when you plan on moving that boat from water body to prevent the snail from getting from point A to point B. But again, very, very hard to see.
I'm wondering if you can talk about other invasive species issues going on within the upper Mississippi, because obviously this isn't the only issue.
No, not at all. Actually, so you hit on one, the zebra mussel. It's still a major problem within the Mississippi River. We've got reports that the quagga mussel is also in the Mississippi River region, a relative of the zebra mussel. And, of course, the Asian carp is moving up from the south, also posing a lot of problems as it moves through and feeds essentially on algae, which in turn has the potential to have major impacts on all of the organisms within the Mississippi River region. So yes, we've got plenty of invasive species in this area, many of which are aquatic.
What is your outlook on invasive species, and not only the Bithynia and maybe the zebra mussel, but others that will come down the line? Because it's not like they're ever going to stop. Is it something that you would like to control the population, or do people need to just learn how to deal with these populations better?
I think under ideal circumstances, you really have to prevent these kinds of invasions from establishing. In a lot of the circumstances, for example, the zebra mussel, once these invasives get into an area, it becomes almost triage. You just have to try to manage the situation the best that you can. And there are a lot of approaches that are being postulated right now to try to, again, prevent invasive species from actually getting in and taking a hold in an area. So what you can do is you can try to model what the optimal habitats of potential invaders might be, and then focus in on those habitats in areas that you don't want to see this organism introduced, and to really go about trying to prevent those species from getting in there.
And what about the Bithynia? What's your outlook on the future of the Bithynia in the area? And is it the Bithynia, or is it the parasites within the Bithynia?
I would argue that it's probably a combination, because of the fact that the snail itself does at least have the potential to impact some of the native species. So from a community standpoint, certainly Bithynia itself is a problem, but then the additional component of the parasite certainly exacerbates that issue when you start looking up the community chain and think about the birds that are involved in the system. Regarding the snail, ideally it would be fantastic to cut back on the amount of waterfowl that are suffering from this particular disease. Again, I honestly think that it's going to take us quite a large amount of time to get to the point where we're in a place to do that. It's just such a complicated system. But again, using mathematics in association with biology can certainly help with hopefully cutting down that time by helping us to focus in on particular aspects of the life cycle that might be most important for the parasite.
I don't know how idealistic this is, but is it possible to maybe shift birds to go elsewhere? I mean, has that been looked at?
That has been an idea that has been put forth, actually sort of force birds by activity actually out on the pools into other areas. The problem with that is that we don't know what those other areas are like too. They might be actually forcing
something
them to areas
worse.
Where there are greater numbers of snails and maybe greater numbers of parasites as well. So ideally it would be nice to try to figure out where the birds reside and to try to go about maybe trying to alter aspects to prevent transmission from occurring in those areas. But there you run into the problem as well, that if you're shifting habitats, birds may actually move into other habitats because that manipulated area isn't what they prefer either.
Are there other ideas out there to stop this problem?
Right now, the primary ideas are habitat manipulation. I think that's sort of at the forefront of everybody's consciousness at the moment, because I mean that I think is probably the most tangible way that we can have the greatest impact in the shortest period of time.
And what do you mean by habitat manipulation?
So again, altering maybe the substrates or reducing the amount of vegetation that you find in a particular area. Other possibilities that have been used in other host parasite systems involve chemical means. So you actually add something like copper sulfate to the water that kills off the snails, but the problem with that is that you don't know how well distribution is going to be with that chemical.
Or if it could affect other species.
It certainly would affect other species as well. So you can run into a real ecological problem when you start using other chemicals also. So that certainly could be a means that we would utilize, but it's not a very easy one to implement given the consequences that come with it.
What becomes of the birds that die if they're rotting or?
And actually that certainly is the case. So a lot of the birds end up down at the bottom of the Mississippi River, which in turn could theoretically influence the microbial community that's down there, breaking down those birds. A lot of the birds actually themselves end up acting as carrion that are fed upon by eagles, for example. So eagles certainly take advantage of these coots and lesser scop that have either died or are in the process of being or succumbing to the disease. It makes them far more susceptible.
The eagles don't then get
the
parasite?
They don't. So once the parasite gets into the form where it's in the birds, it can't be transmittable to another bird or a mammal that might be feeding on those birds that died because of the disease. And same with humans. So if humans end up shooting one of these waterfowl species and they end up taking it home, they don't have to worry about becoming infected with this particular parasite because it cannot be transmitted to human beings in the form that it's in.
Greg Sandland is an associate professor of biology and is with the River Studies Center at UW-La Crosse. The center is doing research into possible solutions to migrating birds that have been dying on the Mississippi River after eating an invasive snail. In a related note, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is once again asking boaters to stay out of thousands of acres of water in designated parts of the Mississippi River's Pool 7 and 8 beginning this Saturday to allow migrating birds a chance to rest and feed. The voluntary compliance is in effect through December 4th. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll hear from a 2011 Wisconsin Teacher of the Year. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. To hear this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. We also welcome your comments and ideas. Simply follow the links on our archives page at wpr.org/lacrosse.